Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
96 years, four generations. When I hear that music, I get jacked to the gills. Why? Because it's another award-winning, action-packed edition of your Studcast. My name is Tony Basilio. In just a moment, I'll introduce the man they're calling the greatest storyteller in the history of podcasting itself. Not just wrestling podcasts. I'm talking about in the history of podcasting itself. I'm talking about Move Over Garrison Keillor. I'm talking about bow thy head when you say his name. Ladies and gentlemen, it is episode 20. Time has flown here. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together, meet and greet your Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Stud, welcome in.
Oh, thank you very much, man. So glad to be here, Tony. It's a beautiful day up here in the Tennessee area. It's just a pleasure to be sitting in the chair again. I got the old horse saddled up, and I'm ready to ride, man.
Couple of ground rules here before we get started. First of all, we want to be as interactive as possible here on the Studcast. This is your Studcast. With that in mind, just as our man Brian Last does things with 605 Podcast, as we are a part of the Arcadian Vanguard family of podcasts, we want you to be able to reach us. And so you can find the Stud's website. In fact, why don't you click over there while you're listening to the Studcast today at tnstud.com. Also, if you want to reach out and touch us, you can do so on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. And the Stud is also found on Facebook, Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud, all spelled out over on Facebook. And Stud, before we do anything else today, we got to let our listener know that we are chronologically moving through your story. It's February of 1964. And just to set the scene here, four lads from Liverpool have come over. They've played the Cavern Club. They've turned Europe on their ears. They have appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, February of 1964. The British invasion is fully upon us. And wrestling is rocking. It is rocking, Stud, right now in fall of 64, where you're going to pick up the story today.
Yes, sir. I'm looking forward to it. I will go back and just to give a little recap here of what we talked about last week. We've actually been in Atlanta now for a short period of time. There's a promotion there in which it's been very successful territory for many, many years. It was run and owned originally back in the 40s by a gentleman named Paul Jones, great wrestler. There's a picture. If you go to the website, you're going to see a picture. If you go to take a look at number 18, you will see a picture of Paul Jones. Quite a specimen he was at that age. And he is still there, and he's still involved. There's another partner named Ray Gunkel, who is a primary partner, has a bigger slice of that Atlanta area. And then my father comes in and buys out a guy named Don McIntyre. So between my dad, Ray Gunkel, and Paul Jones, those are the three that comprise the entity.
Well, before you get started today, and I know you're going to, and I'm looking forward to it, here are some of the names you're going to hear on today's Studcast. And we're going to try and do this going forward, give you just a little menu of what we aim to get through today. We're going to talk about Louis Tillet. We're going to talk about the Torres brothers. Sputnik Monroe's name is going to come up today. Joe and Gene Corsica will be mentioned. The Vachons are going to be unpacked. And Bob Armstrong, a young Bob Armstrong, has just turned pro. Stud, before we do anything else, I got something I need you to live up to today, because our comment today comes from Jason Miller, who hails from the Sunshine State, and he's reached out through Facebook, and he said the following. This is how it's done. Wrestling podcast, take notice. You don't need to talk like a clown for 2 hours or repeat the dirt sheets to stay relevant. Riveting storyteller from a natural storyteller who actually has something to say. Seems to be just what the doctor ordered in time of the endless clone podcasts that are out there. Get them, Stud. With that in mind, Ron Fuller, pick up our story as we're in the fall of 1964. Go for it, my man.
All right. First, let me just real quickly, that's a great comment from that gentleman there. Really nicely said. You know, people say I'm a great storyteller. I think I'm getting that reputation. And I certainly know this subject because it is my family. And I think it puts us in a different place than most other podcasts, wrestling podcasts for sure. And the fact that all I do is my family story, and that I have no guests normally. We did have a program back, number 17, that did have some guests on it, but then we may do it again sometime. But normally, I'm just going to be here telling my story, and I really appreciate that comment, Mr. Miller. That's really nice of you, and I thank you very much, and as I do all the listeners that we have out there, and I'm really pleased to just be doing this. So let's go back, talk, as we said, a little bit about our last episode, and we spoke about Paul Jones and Ray Gunkel and Don McIntyre. We talked about the Georgia territory being a different and unique territory, and the fact that there's an ownership in the northern part of the state, and there's an ownership in the central to southern part of the state. You have a gentleman named Fred Ward, who happens to run Macon and Columbus, Georgia, and in small little towns around those cities. So you have a unique situation here. You've got Atlanta, which we spent a lot of time talking about last week, is just thriving. It's just about to explode in population. It's a great place to be, and it's a great time to be there. And we come in at about that point. When my dad comes, he makes quite a few changes. This is kind of a recap for those that might not have heard last program. I'll do it as quickly as I can. He makes quite a few changes. He brings in a different booker named Leo Garibaldi. He brings a flood of talent into the organization. He starts to use big-time guys like Fritz Von Erich and Dick the Bruiser and Sheik. So he is really taking hold of this, and he's not brought his whole army yet. He begins to bring some of those as we develop and move along the storyline into the 65, into 1965. So they're doing well. They have struggled a little bit. There's a reason that McIntyre wants to leave. He wants to leave because his territory is not doing as well as it did before. He's made a lot of money in real estate business, and we come in at a very good time. Dad just pops it right away. He brings another booker and a lot of new talent. Some of them you've already mentioned. A great deal of those guys are wonderfully talented wrestlers, but they're not normally his part of his army. And as time goes by here in Atlanta, he's going to bring different members of his old army that he used to build Gulf Coast Wrestling in Mobile and along the Gulf Coast of the United States, that he used to build Memphis into the monster it becomes. And he also used some of those same guys in Arizona to really crank up wrestling out west. So we're in Atlanta now. Things are really rolling well. And they make a lot of decisions there that are good decisions for the future. And they start making them. They didn't have an office there, which is awfully odd for a big company like they were. And they're in a big, huge market. So they buy an arena, a small arena downtown. They want to have a building in case that the Atlanta Auditorium that they operate in is booked frequently, because it's basically the biggest building in the city of Atlanta during that time frame. So they want an arena of their own that'll hold a smaller amount, about half of what the auditorium would hold, approximately 3,000, 4,000 people. The auditorium would hold 8,000 or 9,000. In case the auditorium's unavailable, they don't lose their prime night of Fridays. That's the Atlanta wrestling night. And with most territories, they were set up so that the big cities always ran on the same night. You wanted to run once a week, because you wanted to keep your wrestlers busy. And if your fans got accustomed to saying, hey, it's Tuesday night. As an example, once I had Southeastern Wrestling along the Gulf Coast, Tuesday night was Mobile. And if you were a person that lived in the area of Mobile and you wanted to get to your wrestling, you knew that if you went there on Tuesday night, there was going to be wrestling. If the building had changed, it would be told on television. If there's something that happened that changes that situation, then occasionally that did happen. But predominantly, the big cities across the country had their nights that they operated on. So at Atlanta, they went down and bought themselves and not only a small arena, but they made a wrestling office out of it. It actually ran on the weekends on Saturdays. They used it as a nightclub. So this facility had a lot of benefits to it. They had a ring set up in one area of it so that they could have matches. When they had matches, they'd move that ring into the center of the arena, but otherwise they would train there. That benefited them as well. It was a nice little move on their part. When we moved there, we lived in the not too far from the airport on Interstate 75. We moved in the summer of 54 to a little town called Lilburn, Georgia. It's basically northeast of Atlanta, about 30 miles. We rented a place there, and Dad put up for the first time ever in many years since Memphis a ring in the backyard. Rob and I started to train every day. Basically every day. We'd go to school, come back from school. He brought in a guy named Charlie Carr that had trained him, that had trained a whole lot of wrestlers, an old timer from back as far as Roy's dad, Roy, my grandfather's time. So Charlie was very, very great trainer, and he worked with us every day. We didn't do any training except for shooting. He tried to teach us how to beat people, how to hurt people, how to get holds that meant something. If you ever got in trouble, if you needed to know, it was a benefit beyond anything that you could imagine. You didn't know whether you were going to, at some point in your wrestling career, get into a position to where someone is going to try to take advantage of you, either take advantage of you or hurt you. And if those situations came to pass, then you wanted to know as much about what to do to take care of yourself as you possibly could. And that's exactly what happens in this situation, is Charlie teaches us every day how to wrestle. We spend a lot of time working out. There's another guy from Dad's past, one of those soldiers that comes into Atlanta about the same time frame when we're living in Lilburn, and that's Sputnik Monroe again, the gentleman that really popped Memphis back in 1959 and 1960, became one of monster stars there, had such a predominant presence in Memphis that he actually helped the civil rights movement. He changed everything in the city of Memphis because of his appeal to the black people in Memphis. Now, he's come to Atlanta. He's a great wrestler. Oddly enough, Sputnik did not have the shooting background that most wrestlers had. He had such a personality and a charisma about him, he didn't need it. He could draw money without it, and he very seldom had problems because he could pretty well take care of himself. So we spent a lot of time. Charlie Carr lived in a house with Sputnik and his wife, and they were very, very good friends. Charlie liked to drink. It was because he had had an accident. It all went back, and I asked him this question one time. He drank a lot, so I would say, Charlie, why is it that you drink? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, one time he and another wrestler were making a trip, and they had a car wreck. He had his wife in the car. She was in the front seat. The other wrestler was in the back, and they had a pretty bad accident, and he lost his wife. Obviously, he loved his wife dearly. And he started drinking after that. He just could never get away from it. Really, really affected him. But he was a great, great guy. But he and Sputnik had these little clashes. It was odd to be around the two of them because they lived in the same house. And they would have these little arguments. And Sputnik would come and work out with us because he didn't know much about shooting. And he was actually trying to learn while we were learning as young boys, Rob and I. And Sputnik, they had an altercation one day in front of us, and Charlie says to Sputnik, Sputnik's got a little daughter named Natalie. She's probably a year old. She has a crib in their house. And Charlie had this raspy voice, and Sputnik said something that Charlie didn't like. disrespectful or whatever it was. And Charlie says, you know, Sputz, he goes, I could take you and put you in Natalie's playpen. And he said, I could whip your ass and not kick out a slap. And I remember as a young boy, you know, having to turn my head and laugh because I didn't want to laugh in front of Monroe. It might have made Monroe upset. But at the same time, I thought it was a great line. I mean, you know, what he said was actually true. He was such a shooter and so good at it that he could have done just exactly what he said. So we were getting good. Rob and I were getting better. We were learning a whole lot of things. Came to a point, since we're talking about Sputnik, that one time Sputnik and his wife came to visit us, and the ring's out there in the back, and he wants to go out there in the back, and Dad goes out that day with us. Dad happens to be there, and he says, Ron, why don't you and Sputnik go ahead and do some wrestling, you know? Well, he's talking about doing some shooting, because we not learned how to work. We don't know any of that, so we only know how to shoot. So we start wrestling, and I get him in an Oklahoma ride. Now, I can't beat him, but he can't get out of it. And I hold him and hold him for a long, long time. He tries everything he can to get out. He can't get out of the hold. So finally, his wife, she's sitting in there waiting on him to take her home. And she sees what's going on in the backyard. She comes out. She watches for a few minutes. He's straining. He's getting blown up. And she finally says, Ron, I think you're just going to have to let him go because he can't obviously get out of that hold you've got him in. So I'm 16 years old. It's like, it's humiliating for Sputnik, who has been a star in so many places. But it was a feather in my cap, I thought, because I realized that, hey, I'm getting to where I can actually do something with real wrestlers. So it was a nice little thing for me. We stayed there in Lilburn, Georgia for the entire summer of 64. In the fall, as usual, we move again. And we move to the south side of Atlanta.
Stud, before you go any further, before you get there and move to your south side, I'm going to make a note of that. We're heading to the south side of Atlanta before you get to move. I want to ask you a question about Sputnik Monroe, because it's pretty well documented that his time in Memphis, he's a gigantic star. How does his star power translate over to a different city? How did star power translate in the territory era? In other words, we didn't have national television then like we do now. Everything was segmented and compartmentalized. So how would a wrestling fan in those days have known, or would a wrestling fan in those days have known, what had gone on in Memphis? How would I have kept track of the sport back then? Can you just elaborate on that? And what kind of star power did he have in Atlanta? Did he have star power? Or did he have to build it back up? How did that work?
That's a really good question. And you're exactly right. You know, it's not a national product. There's no national television, so everybody can see the same guy all the way across the country. They don't know who he is. They've never seen Sputnik Monroe in Atlanta. He's never worked there before. So he comes in, and he has to do what every wrestler had to do back in those days, is he had to get over. He had to get himself over. And he did not do it in the same way that he did it in Memphis. In Memphis, he went down there on Beale Street and he hung out with the blacks, and they loved him. They loved him to the point that when they came to the matches, they filled the arena and they cheered. Even though he was a heel, they cheered for him like he was a babyface. He had that city in the palm of his hand. Now, he's going to get Atlanta in the palm of his hand, too, but he's going to do it in a different way. He's not going to connect with the black community as well as he did in Memphis, but he has this charisma about him. He has something about him that people are attracted to, and he's going to become a star in Atlanta, but he's going to take a little time. He's going to have to be built. That's how you made your stars. That's how my grandfather did it. That's how my dad did it. It's how I did it once I became a promoter and once I started running my own companies, is you have to build those stars. You can't take a guy that comes from San Francisco that works for Roy Shires, Ray Stevens as an example, and bring him to Atlanta and expect to draw a quarter with him because he has to get over. And that's exactly what happened and had to happen in Sputnik's case.
So there weren't magazines. I mean, even that was kind of in its infancy, right? And in that period, 1964, we're talking about.
Yeah, there were magazines. I mean, there were several wrestling magazines that did stories on different parts of the country. And when you looked at those wrestling magazines, I mean, you could read the pictures and you could read the stories, and I was into that. I was going to be a wrestler. I'd made up my mind, so I was doing that type of thing. But there's nothing like seeing it live and in front of you and hearing him make an interview and seeing how he moves in the ring and seeing how he handles himself and portrays himself. And that's what really makes you get into a person, is you've got to get those intricate parts, and you can't get that from a magazine. And back in those days, they weren't recording a lot of matches. They weren't sending tapes out and saying, hey, here's so-and-so and here's so-and-so. You would have a few places that had matches. They would be old-timey matches or things that they had shot on 16mm many, many years earlier. But it was not to the point that it was going to become when you started producing your television program. Television programs just had the live matches that they had. Later on, during my time, you're going to film a lot of those house matches, and you're going to take that film into the studio, and you're going to show that back to the fans. They're going to then get an impact that they can't get in the studio. In a studio, you got 150, 200 people. When you've got 10,000 out there, and they are making that noise that 10,000 people make, that just makes your product that much stronger, and it makes your ability to get a guy over quicker. It's unbelievable how fast you can do it as time goes by and as we're going to get into that era. But back in the 60s and the mid-60s, you didn't even have, a lot of these stations did not have the ability to videotape. They couldn't tape your show and send it to another market. So it was really a confining little situation to where it's a studio product. It can't be moved from one city to another. And that's the way the business is at that point.
And that's why so much, or so little, I should say, what's out there from that era exists, because so little of it was shot to begin with or recorded. And then a lot of the arena stuff that was shot, Stud, you would use the same tape over and over again for some of your house shows, right? I mean, it wasn't like you guys weren't cognizant, your dad wasn't cognizant, that someday people would even want to look at this stuff, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you bought a videotape. When I owned my wrestling companies, it cost $200 to buy a 2-inch videotape. It was in a big box that was probably 2 feet by 2 feet and 5 inches thick. It weighed 40 pounds, you know, and those things weren't cheap. And $200 back in the day was a considerable amount of money. So you didn't go buy 50 of those and sit them on a rack and let's record these programs and sit on them. You just but jockeyed those tapes and you recorded right over the top of them. So much was lost during those times in the 50s and the 60s before videotape became available, and even after videotape was available, because people, like you say, they had no idea the value that these things were going to have down the road.
It's remarkable stuff. The other thing that sticks out to me when you start talking about the way you guys shot things back then in these arenas, the footage that has survived from that era, speaking of the 60s and then into the early 70s, especially some of that color stuff, is just so beautiful, the video quality of it, because, and you just spoke to that, the size of the tape you shot on and the type of equipment you used, I mean, it was like motion picture quality, some of it, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Some of it was great. As time went on, the cameras got smaller. And they got better, just like everything else in our society. Technology just zooms by, and what's perfect and gets great quality in one day is 2 weeks later, sometimes there's something else that comes out that's even better and less expensive. So it kept developing over the years. You used to shoot on video. I remember when I went to Knoxville in 74 and started my first company, I had a guy that shot live matches for me, and he shot on 16mm film. It was the old films, and those had not the quality that you started getting when you got those video cameras, those videotape cameras that could shoot on tape. The quality was even better, but you had to do it if you wanted to be successful and you wanted to promote and you wanted to do it in a manner in which people needed to see that the product wasn't just a studio product. They did not comprehend and they did not get attracted to it and they did not buy into it when you just had a studio with 200 people in it. It was hard to develop that real burning desire to see it. But once you show them a piece of that video and they see that 10,000 people and they hear that crowd, you've made wrestling fans out of them. They're darn sure then going to go, I want to go down there. I want to be in the middle of that. I want to see that. And that's how it developed. That's how things grew.
Yeah, it's still impactful now, all these years later. One question for you. I want you to take us back to the south side of Atlanta, as you promised us. And I don't mean to keep detouring you, but just a question as a matter of relating this to the period we're in. The guy you had shooting the camera for you and who you might have had shooting the camera for you in some of those house shows back then, do you smarten those people up beforehand when they're shooting this? Do they know that what they're seeing is predetermined, or is that not necessary to do that with somebody that's just going to work the camera for you?
That's it. They're just working the camera for you. I mean, what you want is you want to get the content, and you don't need to tell them anything except, I want you to record this match. And that's all I would say. I want to record the second match and the fifth match. I made sure that they understood who's wrestling in those matches so that I got what I needed, and they'd record the entire match. And then you take those matches down, that film or the videotape or whatever it's recorded on, and you decide what parts and pieces that you want to use. And the rest of it is basically tossed away. And there were times, Tony, in 1974, when I had my first wrestling company, I had so many tapes on 16 millimeter film. I took them with me when I moved south into Pensacola, and I had three huge boxes of tapes, some of the absolute greatest video probably ever shot on 16 millimeter from probably maybe 300 different wrestlers on there. No telling what the value of that was. And I actually, like a stupid son of a gun, took those and threw them in a trash can one day. Actually, I had to have a big trash can to put them all in, like when your garbage truck comes, one that size. I had that many of those tapes and just trashed them. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, ridiculous. I want to pause for a moment of silence and honor those tapes and all that history that you threw out. But again, who knew? Nobody knew. Nobody knew. Who knew the business was going to die? Nobody knew that. I mean, no offense to the business, but it's about as good as dead right now. And so folks are looking for things to look at. Speaking of which, you know, it makes sense that you guys wouldn't have smartened those cameramen up, because you can tell by looking at that product that people were shooting that as if they were on the edge of their seats the way we were on the edge of their seats, the way it was presented then. That's really great insight. So take me back to the – and by the way, you called yourself a stupid son of a gun. I was thinking stupid SOB for throwing all that stuff out, Ron. But take me back to the south side of Atlanta. Go ahead, man.
All right. So we moved. We're on the north side of Atlanta. It's about to start school, and we had talked Dad into leaving us and when we moved north into Lilburn, that little town, we stayed there in the south side of town, and he took us back and forth to school every day for 2 months so that we didn't have to change to a new high school, the fifth high school, in a 2-year period of time. So he decides that he's going to start. I think he takes a real close look at Don McIntyre's career and what he did in real estate. And Dad starts to do what Roy did with his dairy. When Roy had his wrestling company, he also had a dairy. He's building a big, huge dairy at the same time he's building a wrestling company. Dad starts to buy real estate in Atlanta. He doesn't buy houses, he buys land. And he goes to the outskirts of the city, which is smart. So he picks this city called Griffin, Georgia. It's about 30 miles south of Atlanta. It's not on 75. It's just a little west of 75, Interstate 75, where it presently is today. And he buys a farm just outside of Griffin, Georgia. It's probably a 200-acre farm. And it has a barn on it. We get back into horses again. He starts buying horses again. And he's looking for property. He buys property, several different farms in this general vicinity here. And he does the same things he did back in the old days in Mobile, is he brings a bulldozer, he buys himself a bulldozer, and he starts clearing these farms and making nice farms out of them. Then he takes the farm. He's a smart guy. He figures it all out. He deducts what he spends to develop the property, the cost of that, when he sells that property, and then he takes capital gains tax, which he's entitled to, and he starts to make big money by taking these wooded properties, knocking down the trees and making pastures out of them and selling the property for a considerable amount of money more than what he paid for it. It's a smart process, and he begins that in 65. Now, this is going to take place over a period of 5 years. He's going to become a monster person with what he buys in the Atlanta area as far as farms are concerned. So we moved to Griffin, Georgia. I'm in the 11th grade at this point. I start to play basketball in Griffin. I become a star as a junior in high school there. The team is the best team that the school ever has. We are running it in basketball. I'm doing very, very well. I start to get offers and attention from colleges around the country. And I see that maybe, you know, I am going to get that free education that the coach talked to me about when I lived in Mississippi. It's beginning to look more like that. We are at the same time. We've got these horses. We've got dad's back to having a farm. Rob and I are spending our time, a lot of time working, just like we were when we were 8 or 9 years old in Mobile, Alabama. Now we're doing a lot of work in the afternoons and taking care of horses before we go to bed and before we have dinner. We're doing a lot of things in that respect. Now, guys are coming to visit. Wrestlers are coming to visit. It's a good time for us. We see all kinds of different things during this time frame. We get to actually meet more wrestlers than we probably ever have at this point. For instance, Don Fargo. Don Fargo is a name not mentioned so far today that comes and starts to wrestle there. Don Fargo is a star. There's several Fargos. There's Don Fargo. There's Jackie Fargo. There's Rough House Fargo. If you're a Memphis fan or you're in that area, they're not all brothers, but they all wrestled as brothers. Now, Don is probably one of the best. He's got a great build on him, and he has that charisma about him as well. He comes to visit us. And just as an idea for fans out there is how the life was back in those days for the way we lived our life. He comes out and he wants to ride. He's the same guy who in Arizona used to draw the guns and fire them before the matches. Now he comes out and he wants to ride horses. So one day we're out there, Rob and I, we're watching, and he gets on a horse and he's running around the arena on his horse, and Dad's out there, he's got a rope and he's just messing around with the rope and he's throwing it on the ground and stuff like that. And Fargo comes blasting past him at full speed on this horse, and Dad just ropes him like in the movies. And the rope is tied to the saddle horn of Dad's saddle. So it just flips Fargo. Fargo goes from sitting on the horse. He takes a bump backwards off the horse, lands on his stomach, and bounces about 3 or 4 times. Rob and I are looking at each other like, oh my God, he killed him. And he just gets up laughing. He's like, hot dog, that's wonderful, man. That's great. He goes, let's do it again. So I'm like, what kind of guy wants to do that? Same guy goes into the gym. We've got a little gym there that we start working out in. And I've got some friends there that day. And he shows us, he says, oh, y'all want to show y'all how to work out a little bit? So he looks at my bench and he goes, I can't bench press on that bench. He said, I'll fall down. How much weight you got here? We conducted everything we could get onto a barbell. It was probably about, I'm going to say, 350, 400 pounds. And he gets on a concrete block, takes a concrete block, lays it on the floor. He puts a horse pad over the top of it so that it doesn't hurt his back. He lays down on a concrete block. Four of us hand him this 400-pound barbell, and he does 20 presses with 400 pounds. And he jumps up and he gets on the dip rack that's sitting right there. He looks around while he's on the dip rack and he says, what's the biggest dumbbell you got? I said, there's a 60 pounder. Crosses his feet. He said, put it between my legs. So I put it in between his legs. He does 20 dips. Those young boys in the gym with him are looking at each other. And then he gets off and he just walks out and they go, wow, geez, amazing. Well, how strong that guy is. So, you know, though guys were really tough back in those days, they had a lot of strength and a lot of ability, and they didn't get hurt. They were tough.
Yeah, and those are guys, when you start talking about some of those guys, I mean, imagine, these are some tough individuals, people you absolutely would not want to mess with. There are laws of nature, let's just put it that way. Stud, it's about time for us to take a break here, and we come back, you're going to have a chance to ask questions of the stud. We are in 1964. There still are some guys that are going to come up here. Joe and Gene Corsica, the Vachons. We're going to hear about Bob Armstrong. We're going to stay in Atlanta, maybe stay on that farm. But when we come back, we're going to hear from you, your opportunity to take this show wherever it's going to go. As we continue, it's episode 20 of the Studcast, your Studcast, and it continues right after these special messages.
The Tennessee Stud loves Christmas and has created a special commemorative Christmas offer for you, someone in your family, or any stud fan. Give a stud gift this Christmas for the first time. Ride over to the website at tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com, and click on the stud store. Find a great gift idea in the photo section. We all know photos make a great Christmas present, so how about your choice of one or more of the 4 8x10 glossy photos available there? Have them personally autographed to whomever you choose with Merry Christmas 2017 if you like. And they're all signed by the Tennessee Stud himself. This commemorative photo will be a one-of-a-kind collector's item and a very special gift. Or maybe someone you know would love to have the classic Stud Cast t-shirt in black or the new blue on Christmas morning. Give your loved ones or yourself something really different this Christmas. This special commemorative Christmas offer must be ordered on the website only at tnstud.com before December 19th to assure delivery by Christmas Eve. This offer will continue if ordered by January 1st, 2018. From all of us here at the Studcast in Studland, we appreciate your support and we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Don't forget, tnstud.com. That's tnstud.com. Now let's get back to the storytelling like only Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, can do. This is Studcast number 20.
And we welcome you back on your Studcast, Tony Basilio, along with your Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. Stud, it's time for us to go into parts unknown, that is to say the audience here, and see what they have for us this week on Ask the Stud. Are you ready?
Heck yes. Let's see what they got.
First question comes from a guy who's on my all-name team. In fact, my all-name tag team, Thane Ectoro from Atwood, Illinois. Has anyone in your family wrestled Maurice the Fallen Angel Talay? Tennessee Stud, what you got to say on that, my man?
Well, I think there's probably two Talays. I know a guy named Louis Talay who comes along in the 60s, but I also know that there's a gentleman that was born a lot earlier, right around the same time frame as my grandfather, and that, I think that is Maurice the Fallen Angel. That is a different Talay. That is the French Angel. I called him the French Angel. And I got a feeling that my granddad may have wrestled him. There's a darn good possibility, and potentially even my father. I think he dies in the 50s, somewhere in the 50s maybe. I'm not really familiar with the French Angel, but I am familiar with another Talay. And I think we mentioned him just earlier in the program. Mm-hmm. Louis Talay, he comes to Atlanta, and he is a great wrestler. He's a great little heel. He's strong. He has great heat. People just despise him. He does great business for them in Georgia. And I take him, as time goes on, when I go to Florida in the 70s, Louis becomes a booker in Florida. He's a sharp guy. Like, bookers come from wrestlers, and wrestlers, sharp wrestlers, watch what goes on. They figure out how to do things, and they figure out how to work angles, and they figure out how to do the things that it takes to be a good booker. And people then give them that opportunity. They can do it. They are successful at it. They stay a booker probably from then on. They continue to wrestle, but they also book the matches too. And Louis becomes a booker in Florida. When I go to Knoxville in 74 and start Southeastern Wrestling, I take Louis with me. He books for me, some booking for me, and he actually runs some towns in West Virginia for me. He actually works for me again. And when I go to Southeastern in Pensacola, because in 79 I have a problem in Atlanta, I go back to Atlanta, I put Louis in charge of running business, and Louis finds Hulk Hogan. when he's Terry Bollea. He's not Hulk Hogan yet. So Louis Tellez is a crucial character in my life, in my time, and in my dad's time, too. Dad was very impressed with him, and Dad took care of him and really liked him. So the answer to the gentleman's question is, maybe my grandfather, I'm not sure. If my grandfather wrestled him, Herb wrestled him, Lester wrestled him, and possibly even Dad wrestled the French Angel. The Louis Tellez that I'm familiar with, he's pretty much my time frame.
Yeah, the French Angel, Maurice Tellez, just looking him up here, born October 23rd of 1903, died in September of 1954, relatively young man, the age of 51. Russian-born French professional wrestler. They called him the French Angel. He was a big box office draw in the early 40s and was also somebody who was known as the world's ugliest man during his time. I don't think, Stud, that's something you want to be known as, the world's ugliest man. I know there are gimmicks out there, but if you've seen some pictures of this guy, and I just looked a couple up, that's pretty accurate. I mean, I'm pretty ugly, Stud, and this cat is ugly.
Yeah, I'll have to look him up, too, and when we finish here, I'll have to take a look at that with you. Yeah, I know the French Angel, I heard that he was not a handsome guy, that's for sure. And he must have been one of the greats. He actually is born a year after Roy. Roy's born in 1902.
Yeah, there's probably a chance.
Born in 03.
Yeah, there's probably a chance they got in the ring with each other, right?
I would say it's a very good chance.
Next question comes from Elizabeth, New Jersey. Gabrielle Lopez would like to know the following. What are your memories of Johnny Valentine and the King, Bobby Shane, in and out of the ring? Johnny Valentine and the King, Bobby Shane.
Well, great question. Two wonderful talents. Different, but both great talents. Let's start with Valentine. I won't talk about in the ring because I think I've already talked some about Johnny Valentine and what he did in my career to make me a better wrestler. I'm going to tell you one of my favorite stories of all time about wrestlers, and this takes place in Jacksonville, Florida, in probably 1973, I'm going to say. We worked in Jacksonville a lot, and guys would stay over because they went from there to Tallahassee, and they would stay in Jacksonville. It was only 100 miles across the state to Tallahassee, and they would go to the beach in Jacksonville. And Buddy Colt and Johnny Valentine go into a little hamburger joint. There's nothing open late at night like that usually, so they go in there and they're minding their own business. Now, they've both got dyed blonde hair. They both are obviously big. They're obviously wrestlers. You know, most people would say they're wrestlers right away. So they're sitting there. It's a little hamburger joint. It has the bottles of ketchup on the counter and the mustard and that type of thing. And they're minding their own business, and they sit at the bar to eat. And there's four guys at a table sitting not too far away from them. And one of them comes over, and then Johnny and Buddy Colt are just having a conversation. And one of them comes over, and he goes, hey, I recognize you guys. You guys are wrestlers. And Buddy Colt is the closest guy to him. And Buddy says, go away, you know, just leave us alone. And he goes, no, you all are wrestlers. He says, that's that fake stuff that you do, you know. He says, it's so fake and phony. He goes, that blood. That you guys, you know, when you're all bleeding and, you know, it's not real blood, you know, and everybody knows what it is. And Colt goes, get away, man. Just go back over there with your friends and leave us alone. And the guy just continues and he goes, no, you know, it's ketchup. You know, everybody knows it's ketchup. You know, that's what it really is. So Buddy Colt just reaches up. They've got a hamburger in front of them, and they've got the bottle of ketchup there. He reaches up and grabs the ketchup bottle by the top of the bottle, and he rears back, and he hits this guy in the forehead with the ketchup bottle. And the guy goes backwards on his back in the floor. It busts his head open. He's bleeding. You know, he's bleeding bad. He's out cold, and he's laying there. Now, his three buddies jump up like they're going to go over and try to help him up, you know. And Colt says, sit down. And they all three, you know, they watch what just happened. So they all sit down, you know, they're quiet, and they're like, whoa, I don't want it to happen to me. So they sit down, and one of them says to Colt, he says, but look, he's bleeding. And Colt says, nah, it's just ketchup. So, you know, I love that story because, you know, it just really tells you about what that was like. Now, Johnny Valentine, I'll tell you another one about Johnny. This one, Johnny Valentine was wrestlers were scared of him. Regular people got to be idiots to mess with him. And I heard a story about where somebody had a little altercation with him outside a building, and he knocked the guy cold. And there was a policeman that came around the corner just after he knocked him out. He knocked him out, and the back of his head hit the pavement, and it busted the back of his head. And so he saw the cop coming. He just dropped down there, and he got the guy's, cradled the guy's head in his arm, and he said, he goes, "Oh, come on, Jim. Now get up, man. I know you've been drinking, but you need to get on up and we'll get you out of here." And the cop goes, "Hey, wait a minute. What's going on here?" "Oh, this is my buddy," he says. "This is my friend, and I'm going to take care of him, sir. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of him. Everything will be all right." So the cop walks on by and goes away. Valentine drops the guy's head on the concrete and gets up and walks away. That's a couple of little ideas about how messing and confronting wrestlers would be. The other guy we talk about is Bobby Shane. I'll try to keep this very brief if I can. Bobby Shane was a spectacular specimen and a spectacular guy in the ring. He was the first guy, I think, to have a woman valet, and his wife was his valet. He came to Florida in probably 1972. And was there for 2 years. They had such a profound effect on Florida wrestling that people, fans there, would probably never forget him. And he did me as well. What I remember him about him is two things. One is wrestling him. He had the most horrible punch in the back. He had a way of hitting you with his fist in the back that hurt worse than any guy I ever remember in the sport. And I can remember when I would go down sometimes and I would start to get up, I would think, "Oh boy, I've got my back turned to him." And I would turn my body as quickly as I could. I found out very soon, in very few matches I had with him, that he would just wreck your body with that shot from behind. So I never gave him the opportunity after a while. I avoided it. Bobby Shane died in a plane wreck, oddly enough, with one of the guys we just spoke about, Buddy Colt, flying a plane. Buddy Colt was in that plane. Austin Idol was in that plane. Gary Hart was in that plane. And Bobby Shane was in that plane. They were flying from Miami back to Tampa on a foggy night, and they wrecked the plane. They had a plane wreck, and Bobby Shane got trapped in the back seat of the plane. They could not get his foot out, and he went down with that plane. Horrible, horrible deal. We lost one of the great stars in all of wrestling, and he was in his prime. It was a terrible, terrible thing. I hate to leave it like that, but, that's my stories for Bobby Shane.
Yeah, in fact, both guys, if I'm not mistaken, both guys were in plane crashes, correct? I mean, Valentine as well.
Valentine later on was in a plane crash with Ric Flair and a couple of other guys. I can't remember the other guys' names. And that was a horrible crash. Valentine, it ruined his career. It broke him up so bad that he could never wrestle again. And he was such a tough guy that I don't believe anything other than a plane wreck could have put him out. And no human being could have hurt Johnny Valentine bad enough to cost him his career. But the plane sure could.
Stoddard, we got time for you to get back in if you'd like to. You were talking about you were back in Atlanta and back on the farm. We have a few minutes left if you want to go back into that, my man.
Yeah, I would like to. I have another person I want to introduce here at this point, who becomes a monumental star in all of wrestling, and one of my mentors, and his name is Joe Scarpa. Now, Joe Scarpa wrestled for my dad in the Gulf Coast Wrestling back in the 50s, and he disappears. And when he comes back, when we go to Atlanta and we move to Griffin, he's a friend of my dad's, a personal friend of my dad. So he gets a home within a half mile of where I live, where we live. And he becomes a mentor to me. He teaches me for the first time how to start working out with weights. Joe Scarpa had a great body, a great build. Now, Joe Scarpa is going to become one of WWF's biggest superstars when he leaves Atlanta. He's going to become Jay Strongbow for Vince McMahon Sr. and be his champion and draw him a fabulous amount of money. But while he's in Georgia, he takes me under his wing. He teaches me how to work out with weights, and I couldn't have had a better trainer. He's just phenomenal. And he was a great athlete. He was a superb athlete. He would take me and play basketball, and I couldn't beat him. And I was a darn good basketball at that point, but he would push me and shove me. He'd get the ball and he'd back me under the rim, and he weighed 250, 60 pounds. He would just force me underneath the rim, and then he would just flip the ball over his head and score. So he would beat me at basketball. He would beat me at football. He would take me and wrestle me. Sometimes he would attack me in the house and just turn furniture over. He would ride me. He would smother me. I would get so mad with him that I would scream at him. I would say, "Get off me." I would, "Get off me." I'd tell him then, he'd finally get off me. He'd be laughing. And I'd say, "Someday, Joe, I'm going to grow up and I'm going to beat your ass for this." And he would just laugh like crazy about it. I never saw him after he left Georgia. He left in 1966. I didn't see him again until 1973. And I was wrestling Madison Square Garden. He was defending his WWF World Championship in Madison Square Garden. And I sat down in the dressing room beside him. And he looked at me and he says, "Ron," he goes, "I hope you still don't feel the same way about whipping my ass." Because he says, "I think maybe now you could do it." So, you know, he was a great guy. One little thing about Scarpa, to just give you an idea of what an athlete he was. They had a contest. They had the Braves that just come to Atlanta, the baseball team. And they had a contest, and they invited athletes from all different sports to come to the stadium and hit home runs. They pitched to them and see who was a good enough athlete in whatever sport to hit the most home runs. The one that hit the most home runs, they were going to call the greatest athlete that's not a baseball player. And Joe Scarpa got invited. They called the wrestlers and they said, "Send somebody down here if you'd like to compete in this contest." Joe Scarpa says, "I'm going to go." And I rode with him to the stadium in Atlanta. And that son of a gun hit 14 balls out of the park. Nobody else hit 3 out. He was like a phenomenon. I was like astounded at how good he was. The guy was just an amazing, amazing athlete. A wonderful person. I have great memories of him. Just phenomenal memories of him.
Who knew that Chief J. Strombo could have been Chief Nakahoma? In fact, he might have been Chief Nakahoma. Chief J. Strombo and Chief Nakahoma might be the same guy. In fact, let's go back. You know, you were talking about him. His physique was so bad at the end of his run in WWF, but his in-ring skills were so good, and he was so good at the part that he played, stud, that he was believable in that. But when you look at old film of him and you look at stuff that he did towards the end of his career, he was absurd looking in the ring. But he was still a damn good athlete for his age.
And you know what he did? He had a way of, his style was different than most wrestlers. And I think I tried to copy some of what he used to do. When he would do a great sell job and he'd get ready for a hot tag or he'd get ready to take over on the heel, he had more fire. He had more fire in his comeback than just about any babyface I ever saw. And one of the things he used to do that I used to love, he would punch the heel and the heel would take a bump and he'd be in the corner as an example. And he would go to the middle of the ring and he'd face the heel. He'd reach down and grab the mat cover and he would pull it up as high as he could. It was like nobody did that. I'd never seen anybody before or after do that. It would make his muscles expand, and it just gave him a look like, "I'm going to tear you apart." It was beautiful. It was phenomenal. He was a great talent in wrestling.
Well, Stud, I want to say to you, you're a great talent as well, and it's been a pleasure today. We're about out of time. Pack this thing with content today. And, Stud, I know you want to say a special word now, because the truth is, we are 20 episodes in, and you talk about not drawing a dime. We ain't drawing a dime, brother. Talk to me about our new phase here on the Studcast.
This is far away from where I normally talk, but I don't think fans probably out there that listen to these podcasts realize that people that do podcasts don't get paid. There's no money for you. And actually, you have to spend money, because when you're doing a podcast, you've got to have someone to edit this product. You have to have some staff that puts together these questions, for instance, that come from Facebook. And there's a lot of things that go into doing what we do. And Tony, I'm sure that people will go, are you kidding me? We don't get paid. Well, we don't get paid. And I know that people love what we do. And I'll be honest with you, I love what I'm doing. I just adore this. I can't wait every week to get on here and do the next one. And people have been sending me these comments and they say, you know, I like to support you. What can I do to support what's going on? So we're telling a chronological story here, Tony, and we're a long way from the end of it. And people are saying, I had someone send a comment last week that says, I don't want it to end. I mean, I don't want it to end until you get to the end, you know? And what can happen with these podcasts, and it happens to quite a few of them, well, most of them, honestly, don't make it. They don't survive because they're not being paid. You know, I'm not asking to be paid. I'm not saying it. I won't do it anymore because I'm not going to be paid for it. For those people that enjoy this show, and I know there are, by reading comments and things, I know there are thousands and thousands out there that have this same feeling that some that send these comments to me, that they would like to support us. And if you would like to support us and just send us whatever you want, basically the website, it's going to have a spot on the website at tnstud.com in which you can go, you click the donate. It just says donate. If you would like to support us, feel like that we do a good job and that we work hard here and that we do deserve something for what we do. And in order for us to be able to continue years of this, if you'd like to support us, we've set up an arrangement. I have talked to someone. You can do it through the website at tnstud.com, or you can do it through a company called Patreon. That's Patreon. And there are quite a few podcasts around the country and around the world, those that are really successful, those that make it a long time, they ask for your support to keep them on the air. And I'd like to see if the people, if our fans here would like to support us, and you don't have to. We're going to do this show. These podcasts, these studcasts will always be free. There'll never be a charge for these studcasts that we're doing right now. But if you would like to support us, I'd encourage you to do that. You can go to patreon.com/studcast, and you can make a contribution. The minimum contribution is $5. If you want to leave us $5 anytime that you want to, you've listened to a program, you really enjoyed it, and you say, geez, you know, I would like to support these guys so that they will continue doing what they're doing and that I will get to the end of all of this. And there's a lot more, as people can tell, we're 20 episodes in. I haven't even put on a pair of tights yet. I have not gotten to my stories. I have not gotten to my brother, and I have not gotten to Jimmy Golden. I have so many things that I want to present to people in the future here. And I want us to give them an opportunity. Those that want to voluntarily, you want to leave us some type of contribution, a donation as a support for us and what you think we do for you, then you can do it through the website, tnstud.com. Click on donate. You'll just send the amount that you'd like to donate. You can donate as often as you want to. You can never donate if you feel that you don't want to. It gives you the opportunity. If you appreciate what we do, you want to show us that appreciation, that would be wonderful. I think we would both be very happy with that. And I don't know a better way to explain it, but I've done a little bit of research, and I know that those companies and those podcasts that remain and do well are those people that offer these people the opportunity to do this. You mentioned the 605. There's one right there. There are a lot of tremendous products out there, tremendous broadcasts and podcasts that allow their fans, there are thousands and thousands of fans, the opportunity to support them. And if you would like to do that, go then to TennesseeStud.com, hit donate, or you can go to Patreon.com/studcast. And then just leave us whatever you think we might be entitled to, and it'll help us with expenses that we infray and that we incur here from doing each one of these studcasts.
Stud, you're the man. It's been tremendous fun. Again, if you would like to participate in our Patreon program, you can do that at tnstud.com. If you want to reach Ron on Facebook, it's Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud, all spelled out. Instagram and Twitter, Ron Fuller Welch. Stud, unbelievable, man. We are well over an hour. Terrific job by you.
One thing before we end up today, next week I want to do something that I've done before, and I had great response from it. I like to do about every 10 years. We're about 10 years later than the last time I did it. I want to take you around the world again next week on next week's show and get away from Atlanta for 1 week, but do the entire world again and tell them who's here, who's there, where we are, who the promoters are, what the companies are. I really want to do that maybe every 10 years. And I think last time we did it was probably 55. Now we're at 65. So if you would allow me to do that next week, that's what next week's program is going to be about. It's going to be that if you live anywhere in the world, I'm going to touch your wrestling for you next week.
Yeah, but you got to make me a deal here. I want to hear about Bob Armstrong just turning pro because you never got to that on today's episode and you promised me you would.
There was a lot of things I didn't get to today. And, you know, my head's so full of stuff. I'm telling you, it just keeps coming and I don't have enough time. And there's some comments about some people. We're discussing, you and I are just talking about some these extended programs. Take this two-hour program from a super stud cast, and we're going to get to everything that all these fans deserve and what they want to hear.
Super stud cast on the super station. Stud, thank you. A lot of fun.
Thank you. My pleasure. Look forward to next week.
Bow your head when you say his name. He's saddled up. He has ridden. He has taken names. We'll come back with you on episode 21. In the meantime, tell a friend. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, this is Tony Basilio. I encourage you to check me out at TonyBasilio.com. You can find my daily radio show there as we hold it down in beautiful Knoxville, Tennessee. For the Tennessee Stud, Tony B, wishing you a great week. Let's come back and do it again on your Studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.